You are listening to the Brighton Book Club, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. This month's show is all about Brighton Book Festival. The five-day festival runs from the 18th to the 23rd of June this year and will be held at Brighton University for the second year running. In line with its mission to make the marginalised mainstream, the festival reaches a younger and more diverse audience than any other book festivals. More than 50% of those attending in previous years said they had never been to a book festival before. Confirmed guests include best-selling novelist Dorothy Coombson, Guardian columnist and author Nels Abbey, and poets Roy McFarlane and Aflo the Poet. The programme of 20 fantastic events includes an evening of comedy and natural wine tasting with Ab Fab actor Helen Lederer, a day of family fun, crafting and storytelling for all ages with Children's Laureate Joseph Cahello, and a night of poetry, spoken word and music. There will be thought-provoking discussions on the relationship between activism and literature, moving beyond European standards of beauty, writing outside your own culture, and whether it's time to take comedy writing seriously. Aspiring authors will have the chance to hone their skills at the Poetry Workshop and the Writer's Day, where for just £5 they will be able to meet people in the publishing industry, pitch their work, and have the opportunity to win a one-to-one with an industry specialist. On the show today, we speak to director of the festival, Althea Wolf, Shaker Halawi from our Putting People First panel, Tahar Kehar from the Thrills and Spills panel, Helen Lederer from the Booze and Books event, and Roy McFarlane from the Poetry Cafe. You can buy tickets and find more information at brightonbookfestival.co.uk and follow us over at Instagram at BTN Book Club to find out more about the events spoken about in today's show. Althea Wolf, director of the Brighton Book Festival. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me. Thanks for your constant support of Brighton Book Festival.
It's my absolute pleasure. So, Brighton Book Festival is in its third year. Can you bring us up to date from the idea to how it has developed and how it's going now?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously, you know, it was started by the two bookshops, which is Afori Books and the Feminist Bookshop. And I would say one of the biggest changes is that I don't think we're so much a project of the bookshops anymore. We're our own independent social enterprise. So, I mean, we always had a board, but now we've got a bigger board. We've got a bigger team of core team of volunteers. And yeah, I think that's the biggest change, is that we're working as an independent organization. And we still, obviously, we're very much honoring our roots. Afori is our bookseller this year. And we still have links to the Feminist Bookshop. But yeah, I think that's the biggest change over the... This is our third staging, as you mentioned. And obviously we're now in a bigger venue. We have more events. We've got an even more international flavor this year, as I think you're going to be having guests on later to show. And yeah, the festival is growing in terms of, we are really pushing the message that this is a movement now. This is a movement to change not just what's happening in Brighton, but change what's happening across the country. And we're kind of pulling people together all the time. We're creating this family of people who want to join the movement.
So can we have a rundown of some of this year's highlights, please?
Ooh, that's such a hard question because everything's a highlight. I mean, what I'm really looking forward to us all getting together. As you know, we put on a real spirit of togetherness at the festival. So I'm really looking forward to that whole element of it. We've got a wide range of authors and events this year. We've got the Family Festival, which we've got Joseph Coelho, who was the Children's Laureate 2 years ago. We're really looking forward to that. We've got food, as we always have food, but we've got an event around food this year called Around the Table. with Janusz Domagala. I want to make sure I pronounce his name correctly. Domagala, who was one of the British Bake Off finalists. So we're quite excited about that. And I know you have Helen coming on later, Helen Lederer from Ab Fab Fame. So something feels a bit retro. but also her new book's quite exciting. We've got such a good range of authors this year and events and topics. We're talking about beauty. We're talking about food. We're talking about displaced people, forced displacement. We're talking about what it's like to win a prize as an author. We're talking about wine. We're talking about so many different things that I think the whole festival is just one big highlight.
That was a very diplomatic and wonderful way of answering. So I'd love to know a bit about what the response has been to the Brighton Book Festival, you know, from the people that come and from the industry as a whole.
That's been quite interesting in terms of the public response and the industry response. Both have been overwhelmingly positive. I think when we speak to publishers and agents, they jump on the idea straight away. I don't think we get any resistance. People want to be a part of it. When we speak to authors, they want to be a part of it. And especially this year, we've been very much explaining to people in our pitch to publishers and authors and agents, we are talking about that this is a movement, that we're asking you to join the movement. We're asking you to support authors who don't ordinarily get a platform to speak. We're asking people to come on board and push for that change in the industry. And it's overwhelmingly positive. You know, we're not struggling to get people to participate. We really aren't. People want to participate. And then from the public, it's overwhelmingly heartwarming, to be honest. The feedback over the last 2 years has been one where people say, man, this is a space where they've never felt so welcome. They never expected the level of hospitality. They love the fact that the difficult and different varied conversations are taking place. So it has been overwhelmingly positive. And I think one of the key things is that where we can see this is people booked tickets before the lineup was confirmed. People had already booked weekend passes and week passes. So, you know, I think that what else could we ask for, really?
Absolutely. Do you have to, Adhya, love books and love reading to enjoy and engage with the Brighton Book Festival?
Absolutely not. I think you will love books and love reading after you've come to the Brighton Book Festival, or you certainly will want to engage with books and reading. But I think it's not the authors are there and they are there and telling us about their books. But more importantly, we're talking about topics that and themes that impact people's lives. It's about people. The whole festival is about people. And we're talking about things that people come across in life. As we're talking about, as I said, we're talking about food. We're talking about people's experiences of belonging or identity. And that everyone has those experiences, no matter who you are. So, you know, I think if you've never read a book, you will still enjoy the conversation. And you'll certainly enjoy the camaraderie, the togetherness, the hospitality. It's a very relaxing space. And so, yeah, you don't have to be a book lover, but I defy you to leave and not actually want to do some reading.
What books have you read recently, perhaps also in the lead up to the running of the festival, which you think our listeners need to read?
Ooh, okay. Well, so this year, I'm reading Remember, Remember by Elle McRae, who's on our interrupted panel at the moment. So I would highly recommend that. If you like a bit of nonfiction, obviously, Michaela, who's also on the interrupted panel, it's not that radical. I read at the beginning of the year. Varaja, who isn't at the festival this year, but her book, Manny and the Baby, has just come out. Beautiful book, really beautiful book. So if you like a bit of jazz, music is thrown in there. And again, it's one of those stories that has family in it. And so all the dynamics of family. So that's really interesting. And Dorothy Kumson, oh my goodness, Every Smile You Fake. Have you heard of it?
I've read it. It's excellent.
Isn't it really good? It's so good. And obviously Dorothy's our festival ambassador, but that is not why I'm promoting the book. I just think it's a really, really good book. And it's so of the time. So I think everybody will enjoy that book.
Absolutely. So thank you so much for joining us. How can people support Brighton Book Festival and come along?
Buy tickets, get to our website, first of all. So get to our website, which is www.brightonbookfestival.co.uk. Buy tickets, come to the festival, follow us on all our social media, share all our posts, tell your friends about the festival, and also look at possibilities of joining in with us. We are really, again, one of the new things we've done this year is we're really trying to build partnerships, especially with local businesses and local individuals. So contact us. If you go to our website, there's a contact page. Contact us and let us talk about how we can build partnerships. And if you're in a position to donate, you know, money keeps the world turning, and that's how the festival runs. So we're happily taking donations or other ways of partnership. Donations don't have to be in cash. They can be in kind. So, yeah, just get involved. This is a festival for the people. So it's not two or three people putting on a festival. It's a festival for the people. So we want people to engage with it. So come and get involved. That's what we would say. Come and get involved and just contact us by the contact page.
Thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks again, Anna. Thanks for all the love you give us.
Sheha Halawi is a Palestinian author who grew up in a now forgotten Bedouin village near Haifa. She is a writer and lecturer in Arab feminism at Ben Gurion University and is currently working on her PhD. She has written 5 short story collections, one of which won the Best Short Story Book Award in the Arab World 2019 to 2020. Her latest short story collection, They Fell Like Stars from the Sky and Other Stories, celebrates the courage, resilience and triumphs of Bedouin Palestinian women and girls, translated from the Arabic by Nancy Roberts with illustrations throughout by Anna Morrison. Sheha, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Congratulations on the publication of They Fell Like Stars from the Sky and Other Stories. Can you talk a bit about the inspiration behind writing this book?
Good question. Because when I go back to the time when I wrote this collection, it's about almost 9 years or 10 years back. It was the kind of closing a circle of my first identity. It was facing again my identity, my Bedouin identity, because I moved from my village, my destroyed village to Jaffa. And, I left back a lot of memories and a lot of things that I even didn't know how to explain it to myself when it was hurt. So when I started writing, it was like, you know, a river, something flowing without stopping. It was something that I thought it was my bigger and stronger than me. There's, like spots of lights that explore suddenly in my face and came back with very clear details. So I started writing the stories, and 10 years ago, I wasn't really young, and all of the stories were about my childhood and teen, when I was a teenager in this village. I felt that I have, something that I have to deal with it, just to continue my life. I have to open and to deal with these things and continue. It was amazing that I went back to my childhood and all of my world there, I discovered all the women that I left back when I moved from the village. My mom, I still with connecting with her, but how did she affect my personality? Because I had a lot of questions. And then I think I found a lot of answers through these stories. The laws of the Bedouin society, the traditions of the Bedouin society that I used to break all the time, to understand from where these laws, come, why the women in my family were so obedient to these laws. And it was so bad to be like that. I was very angry about these women because I felt they are so weak. But when I started writing the stories, I discovered a very big strength that they have their own world of imagination and stories. And they let me as a child to enter these world. I didn't have the courage to deal with these stories and imagination when I was younger. But now, and when I started writing the stories, I was so proud of them, even when they hurt me, because it was a kind of message that I should take with me to learn about your environment, to learn about the other voices that there weren't here. Because when I won the Kuwait Prize 3 or 4 years ago, I was standing on the stage in Kuwait, and I was just thinking not about the grace, about the prize, about the other people. I just thought about the women in my family that because of them, I reached this place. Because this was their voices. This collection wasn't the collection who won the prize, but I mean the process that brought me to this place, their voices. It was the first voice that they gave me to give the world, to give it to the world, to sometimes to shout, sometimes to whisper, sometimes to say it loudly, but especially their voices.
That was such a gorgeous answer. Thank you so much. I would love to hear an extract. Please, can you read us some?
Yes. I will read from the Umm Kulthum intercessory. We used to listen to the radio with the battery. There was no electricity in my village. So there was, especially at half past six every day, Umm Kulthum was singing, and all the people, especially women, just holding the radio and listening to Umm Kulthum. I was listening with my mom. Umm Kulthum was a part of my childhood, and I think she framed in some way my personality, my fighter, to be fighter, because Umm Kulthum, I will not tell her story now, but she had a long way to go out from her village to be the famous singer in the Arab world till now. So I just used to imagine myself standing or just looking at Umm Kulthum when she stands at the theater and singing, and thousands of people hearing. So this story is about the Umm Kulthum holy personality. So I just maybe it broke this holy with some, news. I brought it to my grandmother, and it wasn't just to tell her she's a little bit, she's not complete holy, Umm Kulthum, but it was to give Umm Kulthum that she's a human like us, and she can, to close the gap between us and Umm Kulthum. So it is. I will read a part from this. You shameless brat. I was 16 years old and she was 61. It was the only time she'd ever slapped me on my cheek, on the cheek. And it rang in my ears for days. It was followed by a thousand scream that hurt me as though she'd slapped me a second time. Now get out of my face. It was also the only time she'd kicked me out of her room, even though I didn't bear her name and I wasn't the oldest of her eight grandchildren. I was her favorite granddaughter from the time I was little and until that night. She had been accustomed to calling me Habiba or beloved. When she called me from her room, she didn't need to mention my name. It was enough for her to say, come here, Habiba. And my everybody in the house would know I was the one in 10. Everybody else in the big house had names she called them by. And sometimes the name would be followed by an identification of how they were related to her. It was as if when she asked them for something, she wanted to remind them for her rights over them and their duty towards her. I came out of her room, my palm covering my humiliated cheek, and hid in my room before anyone in the house noticed my fall from grace. Once the incident was noticed, it would beg the urgent disapproving question. What happened? Then they would present a list of hypotheses for me to choose from, possibly with just a nod of the head. But none of that happened. She retreated for refuge into her prayers and pleas for God's forgiveness, and I into my books and my silence.
Thank you so much. So, Sheikha, you are appearing at Brighton Book Festival as part of an event called Putting People First, celebrating the voices of refugees and displaced people. What can we expect from this event?
I hope you can. First of all, I think it's a very, very important occasion to know us. I mean, us Palestinian people who live inside Israel, because inside Palestinian, inside Israel, also suffering from displacing, from refugees inside. Because I grown up, I'm not from the age of the Nakba, but I also was grown up in unrecognized village, Bedouin. So I think it's a very important opportunity to know this part of the society inside the Palestinian, inside Israel. Also, I think it is also opportunity to bring our voices among other voices from the world. I just don't like the role of victim, because when you just be deep in this place, you won't do anything. But instead of this, you have the duty to bring your voice, not especially my voice, other voices, I think it's a privilege for me to be just in this place and bring with me a lot of voices from this place, very complicated place, very unknown place, you know, not just what the news and the media brings to other people. It is an opportunity to show the people, to meet the people, and to talk with them, and to read some of our, and I think also I believe that literature is a mirror of things that maybe other kinds of media or other things cannot bring as literature. So I hope it will be especially for me and for the other people a great thing.
Thank you so much. You can see Shekha live on the 23rd of June at 3:30 p.m. She will be joined by Maid Adin as part of Brighton Book Festival. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Taha Keha is a novelist, journalist, and literary critic. A law graduate from SOAS London, Keha is the author of two novels, Typically Tanya and Of Rift and Rivalry. His third novel, No Funeral for Nazia, will be published by Nimchi Press. He has served as the head of the Express Tribune's Peshawar City Pages and Bi-Monthly Books page, and worked as an assistant editor on the op-ed desk at The News. His essays, reviews, and commentaries have been published in The News on Sunday, The Hindu, and South Asia Magazine, and his short fiction has appeared in the Delhi-based quarterly The Equator Line, the biannual journal Pakistani Literature, and the OUP anthology I'll Find My Way. Based in Karachi, he teaches undergraduate media courses and is planning a novel about male friendships. Taha, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you for having me, Anna.
No Funeral for Nazia is out now with Nimchi Press. Can you tell us a bit about the inspiration behind this book?
No Funeral for Nazia is about Nazia Sami. She's a celebrated author, and in her final days, she decides that she doesn't want to have a funeral. Instead, she wants to have a party. So the novel is set during the course of a single evening at this party, where secrets are revealed and her friends get together, talk about her life. And I was primarily focusing on alternative rituals of grieving. Every society has their own rituals and rites associated with death, but I wanted to understand whether these rites and rituals help us process our feelings, or whether we're just blindly drowning ourselves in rituals and not achieving anything out of it. The other thing about No Funeral for Nazia is that Nazia is dead from the very first page. So she's practically an absence throughout the novel. And I was very curious about how I could write about a character who is evoked in through the memories of her friends, the experiences they have about her, any observations they may have about her life and the way she was with them. So I was very interested in that. And eventually I realized that I had a setting which was like a mystery setting, something straight out of a book from someone like Agatha Christie. So I decided to subvert that mystery setting and use it for my own purposes in No Funeral for Nazia.
Please, can you read us an extract?
I like to read this particular extract whenever I'm asked to read from the book, because it tells us a little bit about the alternative rituals of grieving and how they can liberate us. So this is at the party. Whose idea was it to have a party instead of a funeral? Farid asked. I think it's absolutely brilliant. You must have saved a fortune. Don't say that, Farid, Dolly responded, mortified by her husband's insensitive remark, especially after their conversation in the car on the way over. Noreen stared impassively at her guests and heaved a loud sigh to indicate her displeasure. Farid's smugness was irritating, but hospitality prevented her from telling him off. I think you did the right thing, Farid's voice ricocheted through the drawing room. People spend so much time on money on funerals these days. They're such impersonal affairs. You can't even grieve openly. She paused, tilted her neck back and chugged her wine, leaving red drops on her chin. Mrs. Sadik, my neighbor, attended a male colleague's funeral some weeks ago. She continued, sloppily rubbing her neck knuckles against her lips. They had worked together for 29 years at the bank and had become good friends, but poor Mrs. Sadik just couldn't cry at the funeral. She didn't want her colleague's wife to become suspicious. As it is, Mr. Sadik is the jealous sort and had insisted on accompanying her to the funeral. Imagine what he would think if he found his wife crying at some other man's funeral. Noreen guffawed happily as she heard the story. Something about Mrs. Sadik's dilemma seemed to make her lose her equanimity and urbane refinement. Had she been hosting a funeral, such behavior would have been frowned upon as a sign of disrespect towards the deceased. But this was different. Through her unconventional demands, Nazia had released her from the constraints of mourning and its etiquettes. For the first time, Noreen admired Nazia's benevolence, the freedom that her death had provided them. She could be herself or whoever else she wanted to be.
Thank you so much. So Taha, you are appearing at Brighton Book Festival as part of an event called Thrills and Spills with Dorothy Coombson and Katie Massey. What can we expect from this event?
I'm very excited about this event because each of us have our own unusual take on the genres we write in. Crime fiction, thrillers, mystery, and everyone's curious about what goes on in the mind of a mystery writer or a crime writer or a fiction writer or a thriller writer. How do they sleep at night? What makes them tick? So we're going to be looking into these areas. And of course, the one thing I'm very excited to talk about is how we deal with minority characters in our fiction. I've always believed that there are certain voices that have been marginalized in these genres, primarily people from a particular race or a particular ethnic group. They're usually the first to die in a horror story. So I think all of us have done justice to the minority characters in our books. So I'm curious about looking into those things.
So you have mentioned Agatha Christie, but I would love to know what other books have shaped you as a writer.
Oddly enough, it's never been mystery fiction. It's always been literary fiction that has drawn me into the world of writing. Neeta Desai is this Indian author who I admire. Her novel, Clear Light of Day, is absolutely terrific. And there's Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things, Sense of an Ending by Julianne Barnes. It's just terrific. So all these books have in some way shaped the writer I eventually became, even though I ended up writing history.
And what's next for you? What can we expect and look forward to?
I'm trying to write a novel about male friendship. We think of men as these fist-pumping bros who just, you know, talk about anything apart from their emotions, but that's really not the case. I don't know if I'll write it within the genre of mystery fiction, but it's worth thinking about what I can do with that area. It's exciting for me to talk about it because I've never really written too much about male friendship. I've always written about female friendship, which is actually an area that I know more about because I was surrounded by women as I was growing up. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And what do you do? Because I know that you often write from the female perspective. Are there any kind of tricks or anything that you do to kind of get in the heads of your characters?
I have to remind myself that when I'm writing from the perspective of a woman, I have to be very authentic. It's very easy to write about women. You can just make it up, but that's not necessarily going to be authentic. So I have to be very ethical about my choice of language. I have a lot of readers, quite a few of my friends who I share my work with, and they help me get the voice right. They help me ensure that I don't overreach or overstep my bounds.
So you can see Taha at Brighton Book Festival as part of the Thrills and Spills event on the 22nd of June at 1:30 with Dorothy Coombson and Katie Massey. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Helen Lederer is a British comedian, writer, and actress who emerged as part of the alternative comedy boom at the beginning of the 1980s. Among her television credits are the BBC Two sketch series Naked Video and BBC One's Absolutely Fabulous, in which she played the role of Catriona. In 2015, her comedy novel Losing It was published by Pam Macmillan, and it was nominated for the PG Woodhouse Comedy Literary Award and the Edinburgh Book Festival First Book Award. Helen, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Lovely to be at the Brighton Book Club. I'm feeling the sea breeze and the deck chairs and loads of books. I'm conjuring them all, yes.
Your new memoir, Not That I'm Bitter, is out now. Can you tell us a bit about it, please?
Yeah, it's only just come out. You're absolutely right. And I'm quite interested to get the reactions. People have said it's alarmingly honest, which I always say is not an entire compliment. But I didn't know how else to write such a thing. And at the front of the book, there's this kind of slightly wacky, passive-aggressive CVs. And I'm looking at it now, sort of starting, oh, my God, 1981. And listing programs that I've been in, because I'm old now, and it was like, have I been in that? Was I in that? And even before Google, you know, like they didn't even put my name in, being a woman. They didn't notice us that much. So it's a kind of an attempt to go, I was there. I wasn't playing a huge role, but I was doing stand-up when other people weren't doing it. That wasn't why I did it, but it was just a reminder. And there, occasionally there, you know, I found YouTube clips of me in a black jacket as ever sort of standing up performing. So it's all quite, it was a reminder really that I started out, it was a reminder that I started out in that way. And I've kind of moved through to the autumn of my life.
Why did you decide to write it now? Like, was there just a moment when you thought, right, this is the time for this book?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, a lot of people wrote theirs in lockdown, understandably, but I've been wanting to do it. But I just never, it's very difficult doing a memoir because do you do it chronologically? Is it really dull? And ultimately, anything I do, I just want to get that irony that I need people to laugh. Why would I write a book unless it was very obviously to cause laughter? That's my shtick. And I have been told that, I mean, it's sad. It hasn't, you know, I haven't left anything out because I always think people will tell you off if you leave things out. So I'm people pleaser. So I've put the grubby, not pretty bits in. But then I want the reader to know it's okay, because when you turn the page, we're going to come back into that kind of, oh, my God, did I really do that kind of voice? So it is as if I hope I'm talking to you or, you know, someone preferably with a glass of wine and going, oh, my God, you know that thing when you did that and they walked away and then I thought, oh, I know, you know, just that whole thing. But just collecting up the bizarre and the strange that connect me to other people and connect other people to me, I hope.
So you also wrote a novel called Losing It. What would you say were the main kind of, apart from the obvious differences between writing fiction and nonfiction, like what was the process different for you?
Well, with Losing It, and that was my first novel, and I absolutely loved, I have to say, you know, when you find something that you love to do, that is just so special. It took me a long time because I was 10 years old when I was a writer-performer. And I did this sort of David Frost sketch at junior school. And then I had to wait like many, many years later when I went around the literary festivals with Losing It. And I thought, this is what it feels like to just make something up yourself that you've done all yourself. It was very special. And literary festivals is like stand-up comedy, but with clapping, I always say. So I just sort of found a direct connection that was uniquely mine. And that was important because I've sort of struggled, like we all do, to be counted. And that's why the title of this book, Not That I'm Bitter, is not that I'm not bitter, because I'm not bitter, but I'm not bitter, if you see what I mean. It wasn't the time. I always thought I'd have a sitcom and I never did, but the book is about it doesn't matter if you don't get what you want, because it really doesn't matter. You do something else. But Losing It was through the eyes of the character, Millie. But again, it's the narrative voice for me that whether it's
through a third party, or the I voice, which was for the memoir, it's close. People have got to believe in that authenticity of the voice. And of course, we all have different tastes, don't we, and predilections. So that's why some people will love one author and some people absolutely won't. And that is the beauty of comedy, because it is so idiosyncratic to the receiver and the giver. And setting up Comedy Women in Print Prize, for instance, where I hope we've given a platform to witty women writers, it's important to have a broad church. You know, it doesn't have to be just cozy crime, rom-com. You can be surreal, you can be observational, you can, you know, it's important that women can just be free and be witty in whatever genre they like. You know, it's not just the one trick pony for funny.
I would kick myself, Helen, if I didn't ask you if there were things that you legally had to take out because they could be completely defamatory.
Yes, there were. The lawyer did have a go at it, and there were some suggestions. But I did check with certain comedians. Ben Elton was lovely and very nice little quote for the book. Didn't check with everyone, but I think we're all right. Because the thing is, there's nothing horrible about anyone. I would never write any. I just wouldn't. Why would you do that? That is so unclassy. And everything is through my eyes. And if you don't put the connections you have had, I call them connections, then it was because I was on the scene when we were young and not married with children, all that, you know, and that is everybody's past, I would say, or a lot of our past. So why leave it out? You know, why leave any of that gorgeousness out?
Absolutely. I would love to hear an extract. Please, can you read us some?
Well, I'll try this as an experiment because I'm very new to this journey of my book. But there was a call from a programme called My Teenage Diaries. And they said, now, did I have any diaries? I thought, do I have any diaries? I have the Melody Maker Diary 1987. I had six. So I went off to record it. So the true, this is just true. So there, these are my diaries, I think, in the 70s. I'm just being loose there. Okay, Sunday, July the 20th. One of the most boring, uneventful, depressing days of my life. Everyone madly excited about the moon. Stay up ever so late, watch it on TV, they land, had to go to bed. Monday, July 21st, USA doing very well on moon, thank goodness. Monday, July 21st, USA doing very well on moon, thank goodness. Friday, July 25th, feel a bit depressed, go to Lewisham, look everywhere for jeans. Saturday, August 2nd, went to town, didn't find Levi's. Friday, August 8th. Went to town in morning, sweated, got Levi's and Jethro Tull LP. It goes on. Nick doesn't write or ring, bit hard at first. Keep thinking about him. He goes to Manchester University on Wednesday. Go to Lewisham, buy more Levi's. I must make myself dislike Nick Cove, otherwise I should be so terribly hurt, more than I already am. It's so difficult. He's the most good-looking bloke I know. Hear that Nick Cove told Jenny to stay available all weekend as he was back from university, depressed and cried, worst week. Forget Nick Cove, forget Nick Cove, forget him, forget him, forget him. I love Dave Wood. And on it goes. I'm only interested in Levi's and boys. I am so lightweight and feeble. But yes, I'm a bit exhausted today because I have actually done breakfast TV, which means getting up very early and not knowing how in 5 minutes to communicate in a jolly, intelligent, witty, charming, accessible, non-boastful way that I've written this memoir. It is impossible. So I'm not at my tippy-top best, Anna.
You are appearing at Brighton Book Festival on June the 18th at 7:30, a night of booze and books featuring yourself, Honey Spencer and Lauren Ray. What can we expect from this event?
Well, I think it's a lovely idea to have booze and books because now I'm starting the journey. I went to a bookshop couple of days ago, and there was no wine, just tea. It was a library, they weren't licensed. So I really had to deal with that. It was fine, it was fine. I sent my other half off to get me a little miniature, put it in my mug, and nobody knew I was sipping it. That sounds awful, but sometimes you have to read the room and get in the zone. So I hope we're all going to laugh at each other and hear from each other. I shall read a little bit better and just chat about, you know, writing and laughs and the broad church that should be witty women. And I will, of course, mention Comedy Women in Print because it's a competition, a platform, and we're going to start again for 25. So we need those witty women writers to apply and get published.
Absolutely. Before we go, Helen, can I just ask you what book shaped you as a writer?
I loved Enid Blyton. I did. I just found that easy. That didn't shape the wit, but it shaped the sense of heroine and good and bad and coziness and connections and aspirations. And I suppose aspirations are in themselves very funny because none of us ever reach them. So I do find that commonality in us all, like just wanting to be perfect, quite funny, because guess what? We're not.
Thank you so much for joining us, Helen. You can see Helen at the Brighton Book Festival on June the 18th at 7:30, an event of wine and comedy and books. Thank you so much for joining us.
Lovely to be here.
Roy McFarlane was born in Birmingham to Jamaican parents and now lives in Brighton. He has held the roles of Birmingham's Poet Laureate, Starbucks's Poet in Residence, and Canal Laureate. His debut poetry collection, Beginning With Your Last Breath, 2016, was followed by The Healing Next Time in 2018, which was nominated for the Ted Hughes Award and the Jalik Prize. He is the editor of Celebrate What? 10 Black British Poets from the Midlands, which was published in 2011. His latest book, Living by Troubled Waters, is out now with Nine Arches Press. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you for having me.
So how are you finding it in Brighton? You've recently moved here.
Oh, it's absolutely brilliant. Somebody just told me that after 2 years, I can't say that I've just popped into Brighton. I am proper Brightonian, or whatever the expression is. But yeah, Brighton is beautiful. I think, coming down here for the sea and being able to walk along the beach and just having this sort, almost like a bohemian spirit in Brighton, artistic and getting involved with so much things. It's amazing. So really enjoying myself in Brighton.
Do you find it quite an inspiring place for your poetry?
Absolutely. As a writer, you look for something different. You look for something that grabs your attention while you're walking along or in the moment. And certainly there's a lot of things that are happening in Brighton. If it's not, I mean, I'm from the Midlands, originally from Wolverhampton, but moved around the Birmingham area, so there's not much sea around but just every day, just to walk by the sea and see something different about the sea is absolutely amazing. And seagulls, oh god, those damn seagulls are everywhere, aren't they? So that I made a poem when I first came because of seagulls. But yeah, the spirit and such a beautiful place inspires you in so many ways.
Tell us about your new collection, please, Roy, Living by Troubled Waters.
Oh, thank you. Living by Troubled Waters is my third collection with Nine Arches Press. And it's sort of like a very eclectic mix of conversation over 200 years, I would say, about enslavement, to the present day, of how my parents survived as Windrush generation, and me and my children, what is being British, but with an African heritage means. And so there's these beautiful stories and conversations, and I hope people enjoy some of the visual things that I've done with the poetry. A thing called Eraser Poems is where you take a script, you go over that script and delete stuff or paint over it, and find new poems out of that script. And I think that's one of the lovely things that I've done in this collection. So yeah, you have to buy one from Nine Arches Press and have one to hold and to have a look at.
Please, can you whet our appetite with a poem from the collection?
Okay, well, I'm going to share one called Mothers of Love. And the reason I wanted to share this is about the idea it takes a village to grow up a child. And certainly when I was growing up in Wolverhampton and Smedic, going around those areas, every Caribbean woman was your mother. And you couldn't back chat, even though it wasn't your blood mother. Every Caribbean mother seemed to get together and disciplined you. So here we go. Mothers of Love. Mothers, wherever they saw us, always greeted us in love. Mother Hill folded it with portions of healings in the name of Jesus. Mother Rowe cooked it in Dutch pots of laughter. Mother Russell, oh, golden brown, shimmered in the beauty of it. Mother Dawkins' table overflowed with it, and Toto and rum cake, oh. Mother Henry planted it in pots and tended to them. Mother Taylor sung and danced under a moon touched by it. Mother Kane spoke in the softness of aloe vera. Mother Stanley spared not the rod. Mother Douglas sent bags of it. Mother Ruby soaked dried fruits in it for Christmas cakes. Mother Brown prayed for rain and rivers of it. Mother Miller sent it by airmail from Jamaica. Mother Folks mixed it with stories and proverbs. Mother Edwards picked it up at the market and passed it on to Mother Campbell, who shared it without hesitation. And Mother Hill, yeah, she can be found late at night, folding more for a new day.
Thank you so much. That was a gorgeous, gorgeous poem and beautifully read. So, Roy, you are appearing at Brighton Book Festival on the 21st of June with Sharon Hunjan and Joe Clement, fellow poets. What can we expect from this event?
Well, if it's as good as last year, if it's anything like last year, it will be amazing. It's what we call the cafe poetry session, where after doing some workshops through the day, all these invited poets come and we just perform in front of the audience, and we dance and we get people to be emotional, take part in it, and just have a wonderful time of poetry. And I mean, when we talk about Sharon Hunjan, she's and a great poet who wrote this excellent book called Four Brown Girls. And man, she will bring the fire into the place. Joe Clement is a powerful working class worker from the working class background, who's Gypsy, Roma, and traveler heritage. And what we really wanted to do this year is to get a really diverse voice of people who are from diverse backgrounds and at that kind of, at the edge, as it were, whether it be a minority background or whatsoever. But we wanted to be so diverse that we have a diverse audience and we're all kind of collaborating together and making a song and dance of the evening. So please come along, because I think, because Roy McFarlane's doing the host, it's the highlight of the whole weekend. So you can't miss it.
Absolutely not. Not after that pitch. So that is on the 21st of June at 7 p.m. and you can get tickets from the Brighton Book Festival website. Roy, I would love to know what advice you'd give to anyone who wants to start writing poetry.
Okay. As stupid as it may sound, write. Because oftentimes we have all these poems in our heads, or oftentimes we think, oh, is this really poetry? Oh, I'm not sure. And sometimes some of us are traumatized from growing up And at school, when they told you to look at a poem, analyze, pull it apart, tear it, and all that kind of thing, and we get traumatized. Oh, I can't do poetry. I can't rhyme. I can't do this. Doesn't matter. Poetry is about the emotional content of writing. And so whether you're writing about mom and dad, whether you're writing about ice cream, seagulls, whether you're writing about the weather or history, write it down, write it down. And the second thing I'll ask you to do, read. You can't be a poet if you don't read poetry. A lot of people say they don't want to be influenced by reading books and might influence the way. We are influenced by the TV, films, whatever. So please grab a book, a poetry book, read it. And when you find somebody that you love and it's exciting and it talks the way that you talk, try and be inspired by that writer and write poems like that writer. And then you will become an amazing writer.
That's excellent advice. Thank you so much. And I'd just like to ask a quick question about poetry publishing, because I know it's very different from kind of traditional trade publishing. What advice would you give to people that have, say, put a collection together and are looking to, find a market for that?
Okay. I mean, the first important thing is that you have to be out there, whether it's been an open mic poetry, and I know not everybody goes to that, but you have to be in some sort of circle. Book reading, I don't know, but you have to find yourself at book festivals, right? It is important. Most publishers will not look at your work if you've not sent it off to a magazine, online magazine or a proper, they're all proper, online magazine or the written magazine that you hold in your hand. Competitions, you have got to be in. So whether you're shortlisted or you won a competition, these show that you've got some sort of foothold within the poetry world, and they're saying you know what you're doing. And once you've done that, you look for publishers that kind of publish similar things. So if your poetry is about horror, you're not going to go to publishers that do love poetry. So find a publisher that is akin to the stuff that you write. Mm-hmm. Read their instructions before you send it off. Many people don't read the instructions. If you fail to answer the 20 questions and do the instructions right, they're not going to look at your collection. Mm-hmm. So read the instructions. Make sure you send your poems to people that are similar to what you're writing, and then hopefully you'll get published.
Thank you so much for joining us, Roy.
It's been a pleasure. And once again, thank you for having me.
You can catch Roy, as well as fellow poets Sharon Hunjan and Joe Clement, as at Brighton Book Festival for an evening of poetry, music and laughter on the 21st of June at 7 p.m. Thank you for listening to our Brighton Book Festival special. You can support the festival and make a donation over on their website. Do make sure you're following the Brighton Book Club Instagram page over at BTN Book Club. And if you have a suggestion for the show, email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. You can also listen to the show as a podcast, which you can download wherever you get your podcasts. And if you fancy it, give us a little rating. Every little helps. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next month for our Summer Reads special.